this talk might kill a few birds with one stone. During the break, I was asked by people saying they're in forms like university ministry, where on the one hand you go to run talks to edify the believers, but at the same time you're trying to do outreach to the non-believers. Well, I also work with City Bible Forum in Sydney, and one of my jobs is to be a public speaker. One of my jobs is to give lunchtime Bible talks to workers. 80% really of the people who turn up are going to be believers hoping to be edified from the Bible. 20% might be non-believers coming to check it out. So there's the challenge of the mixed audience. But also I'm going to do something today just to mix things up. I'm going to give you an example topical evangelistic talk, and then we can break it down. Why did I go topical? No great reason except that most of us have been trained quite adequately if we went to Bible college on how to give an expository evangelistic talk. There's John Chapman's book, Setting Hearts on Fire. Some of us were lucky enough to be trained by John Chapman. It's often role model to us by many great preachers, expository evangelistic preaching. But we haven't had much exposure to another tool we can use, and which is topical evangelistic preaching. So for the next 20 minutes, I'm just going to give you a sample lunchtime talk of what I might give to workers at lunchtime. So you might see how this might, I'm not saying it will work, so I'm saying it's a good example, I'm not saying it's a great example, it's not a perfect example, it's not the only way of doing it, you might have a better way, but it's a good example of how to preach maybe to a mixed audience, and it's an example of a topical talk. It's going to go for 20 minutes, and then afterwards you're going to have 30 minutes where you can ask me any question you want about the talk, and then we're going to have lunch, and in the final hour you can ask me any question. So how does that sound? So maybe for the first, for the Q&A, this one, ask the questions about the topic we're talking about, I'm about to give you, and in the final session, more general questions. So this is my sample topical evangelistic talk, which I will give at lunchtime to a mixed audience of believers and non-believers in the workplace. Humans are funny, and we have a funny relationship with work, because we invent a machine so that we don't have to walk anymore. And then we invent another machine where we have to pretend to walk. And then we invent machines where we don't have to take the stairs anymore. So then we invent machines where we have to pretend to take the stairs. We invent machines where we can lift heavy objects. And then we invent other machines where we have to pretend to lift heavy objects. See, we can't get away from work. Every time we invent a machine that takes away work, we invent another machine that gives back the work we took away. See, work dominates our human existence. There's homework, there's job work, there's housework, there's kitchen work, there's garden work, there's stay-at-home work, there's work, 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 work. It dominates our human existence until we retire, and then we complain that we don't have any work. And we have a funny relationship with work, because Hugh Mackay says, once upon a time, if you ask the average Australian, how are you, they would answer, I'm good. Now, if you ask the average Australian, how are you? They say, I am busy. We are so busy with work. We're working longer hours. Both partners are working now to pay the bills, yet costs go up and up. Things are less affordable, so we're more and more stressed than we used to be. So today we're looking at work. How can I find meaning in my work? And we can define work as human activity which is productive and purposeful. So it's not sleep, it's not play, it's not eating, it's work. It's purposeful, it's constructive, it's human activity. And our question is this, how can we find meaning in our work? Now, we're going to look at a part of the Bible called Ecclesiastes, and the person writing this asks exactly the same question. So I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. The Bible's asking the same question we're asking. Work, what's the point? Where's the meaning? Where is the joy? And that's what we're going to answer now in a 20-minute talk, and afterwards you can ask me any question that you want. So the talk will have two halves. First half we'll look at the problem with work, and in the second half we'll look at solutions, and here we might see what the Bible might have to say about work as well. So let's begin with the first half of the talk. What is the problem? The problem, and here I suggest three things. Number one, work doesn't feel purposeful. There's no purpose to our work. This is Dan Ariely. And in his TED talk, he talks about a famous experiment that they did at Duke University, where they divided people into two groups, and in one group they gave them a set of Lego and they got them to build the car. And afterwards they got $3 for building the car. And they went, ta-da, and they put the car on a top shelf like a trophy. And then they gave them another kid and said, do it again, but this time we'll pay you a bit less. And so they did it again, ta-da, and it went up on a shelf like a trophy. And they said, we'll do it again, but this time we'll pay you a bit less. Then they went to another group and they gave them a set of Lego. They said, build it. And they built it and they gave them $3, but then they just took the thing all apart in front of their eyes and they said, do it again, and this time we'll give you a bit less. And so they did it again, and then they took it apart in front of their eyes and said, do it again, this time we'll give you a bit less. So for the first group, where it looked like there was a purpose, ta-da, they kept doing it over and over again to the point where they got paid nothing. See, it wasn't about the pay, it was whether it was purposeful or not. The second group, well, they just did it a few times and they just stopped doing it. It's like, I don't care what you're paying for me, but if there's no point to this, I'm not doing it anymore. See, it's not about the pay, because no matter what they pay us, it'll never be enough. It's whether there's a purpose to what we're doing. This is Steve Bidoff. He's an Australian psychologist. In his book on manhood, he looked at what leads to satisfying work, and he found it was all about purpose. It's whether there's a purpose or not. And he said that's why the jobs that have the highest rate of job satisfaction are nursing and teaching, where there's an obvious concrete purpose to what we do, even though the pay's not that much. See, it's not really about the pay, because no matter what they pay us, it'll never be enough. It's whether it's purposeful or not. And this is a real problem, because Barry Schwartz in his TED talk said, once upon a time with work, there was an obvious concrete purpose. You might bake some bread, or you might make a table, or you might repair some shoes. But now we have atomized work and specialized work, so we do the same small task over and over and over again, and we're just a small cog in a bigger machine where there's no obvious purpose to what we do. And this has made work monotonous, meaningless, and soul-destroying, according to Barry Schwartz. So that's the first problem with work. There's no obvious purpose. The second problem is this. Work is based on a meritocracy. Work is based on a meritocracy. This is Margaret Heffernan. In her TED talk, she talked about an experiment they did at Purdue University. They got all these hens that laid eggs, and they separated them. In one group, they had the high-achieving hens that lay a lot of eggs, and in the other group, they had the mediocre-achieving hens. They laid eggs, but not that much. Well, at the end of the experiment, the mediocre hens, well, they were mediocre. They'd only laid a mediocre amount of eggs. The high-achieving hens, they were all dead. They had pecked each other to death. And see, that's the problem. If we base work on a meritocracy, it's actually a dog-eat-dog world. There's a pecking order. There's a hierarchy. It's a meritocracy. And it's a zero-sum game. See, why do we study so hard at high school? It wasn't about the learning. It's about the ranking. It put you on a curve. It gave you a percentile. It was a meritocracy. And if you had a good ranking, then you get in university. And then even the courses are ranked. Medicine is supposedly better than dentistry. Science is supposedly better than arts. Not because they are better, but they reflect a better ranking. And then the universities are ranked. Sydney is supposedly better than New South, which is supposedly better than Newcastle. Why? Not because they are, but the ranking. You needed a better percentile to get into Sydney than New South Wales Uni. And then we project this meritocracy onto our children. Suddenly we think, oh my gosh, what percentile are they? Are they walking yet? Like, they're not walking. What percentile are they? Are they talking yet? Oh my gosh, what percentile are they? Oh no, they've just wet the bed again. Now they're definitely off the chart. They'll never be doctors or lawyers. They're still wetting their bed. And then we put them into sports. Why? To get them ahead of the curve. We make them do languages. Why? To get them ahead of the curve. We're always trying to get ahead of the curve. It's a meritocracy. It's a zero-sum game. It's a dog-eat-dog world. And that's why even at work, we can't tell our friends at work what we make for a living. We can't tell them we're looking for another job. We can't tell them we've just been headhunted. Why? Because we're actually competitors. It's a dog-eat-dog world. It's a meritocracy. It's a zero-sum game. So that's the second problem with work. It's based on a meritocracy where we're actually competitors and we're competing against each other and it's all about our ranking. And the third problem with work is this. We never get to enjoy what we're working for. There are no obvious rewards. So here are my three boys, Toby, Cooper and Jonty, aged 9, 7 and 5. Three boys, very active boys. And so I often take them to the park. And I think when I take them to the park, oh, it's going to be so nice. I can relax. I can watch them play. Here's my coffee. Here's my newspaper. Oh, but when I get there, they don't leave me alone. It's like, Dad, 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 push me on the swing. Dad, 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 look at me. Oh, I've hurt my knee. Dad, Dad, Dad. I think, oh, I never get to enjoy the park. It's work, work, work with no rewards, no enjoyment of my work. And that's what happens to us. Okay, we work hard to pay off the house, but we're never home because we're always at work. We work hard to pay off the car, so now we're always in the car going to and from work. We work hard for the children's future, but now we're never home with our children. So we're working, but not enjoying the rewards of our work. And who are we working for anyway? Because whoever we're working for, they're not going to enjoy what we're giving them. So this is David, and this is Malcolm Gladwell in his book, David and Goliath. He says, every culture has worked it out that there's a three-generation problem. Every culture, every ethnic group, every language group has worked out this is how it works. The first generation will become wealthy. Out of hard work, they pull themselves out of poverty and they become rich. The second generation enjoy the wealth because they feel entitled to it. And the third generation will lose the wealth because they forgot about the hard work that got them there. So whatever we work for is going to be gone after three generations. And the Bible says the same thing. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish, yet they'll have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labour under the sun. For a person may labour with wisdom, knowledge and skill, and then they must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. So the Bible says this is the problem with work. This is the problem with work. There's no obvious purpose, there's no obvious reward, and the people are just going to waste away what we work for anyway. So what might be a solution? And here I suggest two things. And this is what the Bible hints at, the solution. Well, what do workers gain from their toil? I've seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He's made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. I think that's the key. This is the gift of God. And I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing taken from it. God does it so that people will fear him. So how do we find meaning in work? Here I think the Bible suggests two things. Number one, work is a gift from God for us to enjoy. Don't make less of it than what it is. Don't make more of it than what it is. But it's a good gift from a good God to enjoy. Now, we have a friend called Heather, and she went away to the United States, and she came back with these toy lightsabers for my boys. And my boys were at first very excited, because my middle child, Cooper, he had wanted the green lightsaber, but Heather came with a red lightsaber. So at first, Cooper was so disappointed. Oh, I wanted a green lightsaber. Look what you gave me. It's a red lightsaber. But his disappointment only lasted a few minutes because then he realized the dynamic. Hang on. I didn't earn this lightsaber. I didn't work for it. This was a gift from Heather. And it's a sign that she loves me. So I should enjoy it for what it is. A gift from a good person for me to enjoy. And we need to reframe the way we see work. It's a gift from a good God to enjoy. It might not be what we had wanted for ourselves, but it's a gift from a good God to enjoy. And we really didn't earn it. Work is not really a meritocracy, because then, yes, we can work hard, but there's so many things out of our control. We didn't choose our parents. We didn't choose what country we grew up in. We didn't choose what school we got to go in. They're a gift from a good God that set up this work that we can enjoy. There are plenty of people in Siberia, Somalia, and Syria who work just as hard as us, and they would love to have the job that we have, but they don't. Not because they didn't work hard, not because they weren't smart, not because they didn't have the right percentile or ranking, but we have a gift from a good God to enjoy. So that's the first thing, reframe the way we see work. We didn't gain it as a meritocracy. Yeah, we worked hard, but it's a gift from a good God to enjoy. It might not be the job we'd chosen for ourselves, but it's a gift from a good God to enjoy. The second thing to understand is this. We might not see the purpose, but God has a purpose for what we do. This is the 1980s iconic movie, The Karate Kid. And as you know, it has The Karate Kid and it has Mr. Miyagi, the trainer. And they have to train for a karate tournament. And it's very frustrating because The Karate Kid wants to learn karate, but the trainer just gets him painting his fence and waxing his car. And for The Karate Kid, this is frustrating. There is no obvious purpose for what he's doing. But as we know, come karate tournament time, suddenly, oh, there's an obvious purpose. This painting the fence was, oh, these are all the defensive moves. Wax on, wax off, wax on, wax off. And suddenly he won the tournament with these moves of painting the fence and waxing on and waxing off. He couldn't see the purpose. But there was purpose. So it all comes down to this. Can we trust that there is a God behind this universe? And even though we can't see the purpose in what we're doing, he has a purpose. And really, this is the choice. This is a choice. Choice number one. You know what? You're right. All we are atoms and molecules. I'm just the sum of my material parts. There is no God. There is no purpose. Events are just events. Get over it. Things just happen. Get over it. Any purpose we construct is just an artificial social construct, which is an opiate for the masses. Really, just do your thing and get over it. There is no purpose. Or there really is a loving God behind this universe who wants a personal relationship with you. And he has a purpose for what we do. No matter how mundane, he has a purpose. And if we're Christians who know Jesus, it goes more than this. Because in the New Testament part of the Bible, it says we as Christians, we don't just work for our earthly organization. Jesus is our real boss. We serve him. And he will make sure we get the reward for our work. We might not get reward of our earthly bosses, but he'll give us the reward we should get, maybe not in this lifetime, but the lifetime to come. And he has a purpose, and his purpose is this. We are part of his kingdom, and everything we do is a way that we can bring Jesus' love, mercy, and goodness onto this planet. We are part of God's plan for love, mercy, and goodness in what we do. So how do we find meaning in our work? Today I've argued that if there is a God, work is actually a gift from a good God to enjoy, and even though we can't see the purpose, there is purpose, and if we have Jesus, we're actually working for Jesus, he will reward us, and we're actually part of a bigger purpose to bring his love, mercy, and goodness on this planet. Now I work one day a week as a doctor, and I work as a surgical assistant, and you're probably wondering, what is a surgical assistant? Okay, this is what a surgical assistant is. Let's say you go for an operation at a private hospital. Afterwards, you're going to get three bills from the doctors. First bill is from the surgeon. You go, okay, fair enough, the surgeon. Second bill is the anaesthetist. Fair enough, anaesthetist kept me alive. I'll pay that. Third one, who is this bozo sending me a third bill? That's me, the surgical assistant. And so my most important job is before you go to sleep, I've got to say, hi, I'm Sam, I'm the surgical assistant, and you'll be getting a bill from me in 2 weeks' time. And that's the last thing you hear as you fall asleep. So I work one day a week as a surgical assistant, and I get paid per case. So if we have 10 cases that day, ka-ching, 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 I get paid 10 cases. If we have just one case, ka-ching, doesn't even pay the petrol. And I remember one day I was driving out to work in traffic, 50-minute commute for one case. and I'm stuck in traffic and I think, what is the point of this? Really, is this worth it? I'm in traffic, I'm going nowhere, this isn't going to pay for the petrol, it's just one case. And so I think, what are you talking about? This job is a gift from God. People smart and hard working, we'd love to have the job you have right now. You're a doctor. And it's obviously purposeful. You're going to operate on someone's knee. You're going to make them better. This person's a father. They're a husband. They're a worker. You're going to make this person's life happier and more meaningful. And this job is your way of serving Jesus, bringing his love, mercy, justice and goodness on this planet. Now you're probably thinking, yeah, but you're a doctor. They make movies about doctors. I am an accountant. And I say, not true, not true. I once sat next to an accountant at a dinner and we asked each other what we did. He said, well, I'm an accountant. I'm an auditor. And I said, oh, listen, I don't know how to say this, but tell me, I hear auditing is not very exciting. And he went, whoa, not true, not true. As an auditor, you are chasing the money trail. You're trying to see where they're hiding and moving the money. Because what they tell you is not what they're doing with the money. So you're chasing the trail. You're looking for crumbs, for fingerprints, for clues. Where had they put the money? In other words, you are not just an auditor. You are a detective. That's how he saw himself. And they do make movies about detectives. It's like you're a true detective. You are Charlie's Angels. That's the glamour in the job. So it all comes down to how we see our work. That's our choice. If there is no God, we're just atoms and molecules, there is no purpose, things just happen, get over it. Or there really is a loving, personal God, our work is a gift from a good God to enjoy. And if we know Jesus, Jesus is our boss, he will reward us. And this is our way of bringing his love, mercy and kindness on this planet. So every day I get to drive my boys to school, do the school drop-off, and we go around and we say a prayer on our way to school. And this is how they pray every day. They say, dear God, thank you that we have school. Thank you that Dad can work today and pray that we can have fun. And that's what life is all about, enjoying things from God, like work, as a good gift from a good God to enjoy. All right, so that's the talk. Can we get the screen up? Anyone know how to get the screen up, please? And then we're breaking down. So you can, let me get a pen. And you can ask me any question now about that. Basically the method behind the madness. What are we doing? Why are we doing it? Yes. I have so many things going on. One thing is, I if we can get the screen up, oh, perfect. When I teach my students how to do talks, most talks, and especially topical talks, we go through three logical moments in a talk. There's the first talk where I'm looking for resonance. In the second moment of the talk, I'm looking for dissonance. Oh, gosh. Dissonance. And then the third moment, I'm finding a way to give them gospel. So they're not necessarily chronological moments, like exactly one third of talk, one third of talk, one third of talk, but there has to be a logical sequence through this. So I explain to my students, so the first third, I want you to get your audience to nod their heads as much as possible. Say as many things, get them nodding their heads, go, yep, 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 that's me, that's my world, yep, you got me, yep, I hear you, yep, that is what I see, yep, that is what I do, yep, 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 that is my world. So do as many things as you can to get them nodding their heads, yep, 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 you got me. So if you can picture them nodding their heads, you're doing a good job. First logical third of the talk. Second logical third of the talk, I've got to get them to a, I had never thought of that before. Moment. So this is a yep moment. Get them nodding their heads. This is a moment. And what you're doing there is disequilibrating them, getting them unsettled. Here they're settled, here they're, I never thought about that. So educators use this analogy. Everyone is a full glass of water. If you try to give them water, they go, no, dude, I've got a full glass of water. So at some stage, you've got to empty the glass of water in front of them. No, dude, you've got an empty glass of water. Oh, okay, I'm ready for you to fill my glass of water. It's like a guy when you walk into a shop and the salesperson says, can I help you? You first say, nah, I'm good. But you're not good. You don't know where the shirts are. You don't know. But I'm good. It's the same. You come in too quickly with your message. I'm good. The defense is up. So you got to move in. I never thought about that. I've got a problem. I've got a deficiency. I've got something clashing in my life. And so maybe that moment is I'm showing them maybe it's a dog-eat-dog world. They can cope with that. But maybe the big heart moment is you're not getting the rewards for what you're working for. What are you working for? You're working to pay off a house, but you're never home. You're working to pay off a car, so now you're just stuck in the car. You're working for your children, but they're going to waste away what you give them. They're not going to appreciate it. Really, what are you doing this for? And you're never home to enjoy your children because now you're working for your children. So, you're right, I have a problem. So now you're ready to give them the Bible solution. Using another metaphor, this is using Tim Keller's metaphor, you've got to identify their culture's storyline and give it back to them. So say, this is your storyline. This is your purpose. This is your meaning. This is a happy ending you're chasing. And at this moment, they go, you show them, I like your storyline. I like what you're chasing, meaning, but, you're not going to get it your way. You're actually not going to get the happy ending you thought you were going to get. Oh, but Jesus will give you the happy ending you're looking for because it's a God-given legitimate drive that you're trying to fulfill. But Jesus will give you the happy ending. He's the only way of getting the happy ending, so that's syncretism. But he's a far better... So you're combating syncretism, so you can't keep your way and Jesus at the same time. He's the only way of getting the happy ending, but he's a far better happy ending than you had dreamed of. So there's an attractional component of the gospel you're trying to show them. Okay, and then I don't know how much to reveal, but I'll reveal one more card and then I'll throw it back to you. The other trick then, not trick, well, method, and I learned this from Timothy Keller, who learned it from Paul in Acts 17, you quote their authors, before you come to your authors. So then, you look at Tim Keller when he writes Reason for God, he identifies their defeater belief, then he quotes their authors, their movies, their poets, their writers at them, and then he takes them to the Bible. And that's what Paul does in Acts 17. He quotes their authors. This is what your poets say. In him we live and move and have our being. That's what your songwriters sing. And then he comes to the gospel. So you notice there I started quoting their authors. Malcolm Gladwell, Stephen Bidoff, Margaret Heffernan, the TED speaker, Barry Schwartz, the TED speaker, Dan Ariely, the TED speaker. And then I show them there's an overlap because of God's general revelation of common grace between what your author is saying and what the Bible is saying. So look, hey, the Bible is saying the same thing. Who would have thought? And then slowly you woo them to your authors. Right. Ian, you had a question?
No.
Yes.
So that was going to be my question, the their authors thing.
Yeah.
Sorry, you said Malcolm Gladwell and
Hugh McKay at
the start.
How are you
selecting them?
Okay, yep. Good question.
For Australia, because I think in the US, he can point to Martin Luther King Jr. and everyone will just nod because he's
like,
you know,
I understand
that.
Yeah.
We don't have
Nicola. Right. Okay. Well, how am I choosing my authors? So first of all, I'll backtrack. So what is the theology behind what I'm doing? And I hinted at the earlier question. Understanding because of God's general revelation and common grace, there will be truth out there that's all because all truth is God's truth. So I just need to find continuity between general revelation and special revelation between their authors and my authors, i.e. the Bible. So there should be some continuity, not total continuity. And that's obviously the Bruno Bart debate, how much continuity is there, and so you're sort of stumbling into that, but let's not worry about that. So how do we find out their authors? What I do is I trawl through the bestsellers list of New York Times, especially see what's and just see what's happening in there. And some of you find there's a whole canon of literature where authors just refer to each other. So when I was at Bible college, I had a whole canon of Christian authors that I had to read. Students always ask me, have you read this book? Have you read this book? And suddenly, after a while, there's a canon of authors you're meant to have read. Carson, Van Hooser, Keller, whatever. Now that I'm with City Bible Forum and interacting in the secular world, I'm realizing there's actually the same canon of non-Christian authors. It's quite self-referential. They refer to each other. An easy way to stumble upon it is to check out the bestsellers list in the New York Times. And I said that to Al Stewart. He started doing that. He said, this is brilliant. These books are amazing. So especially the non-fiction, as well as the fiction. And what I do, as I listen to podcasts on my way to and from work, so every day I go through 2 hours worth of podcasts. So most of those things came to me from podcasts. So the TED Talks all came to me from podcasts. And the more I read Australian Facebook posts, when people say, what podcast should I listen to? They're all listening to these American podcasts. So I don't think the disconnect between America and Australia is as strong anymore. We're looking to America for even our secular non-Christian leadership. And so I'll just throw up some of the podcasts I've been listening to. So there's been The Moth Story Hour I've been listening to. And you guys are all nodding your heads, so you probably know all this. The TED Radio Hour, and that's where I got the Margaret Heffernan quote, the Barry Schwartz quote, the Dan Ariely quote. I go to This American Life. I go to Freakonomics. And this is so self-referential. So many of the people that they discuss on Freakonomics, I hear on TED. So the Barry Schwartz and Dan Ariely have all been on Freakonomics. Suddenly I realize, hey, this is a canon of self-referential authors. It's actually really easy to get on top of who these people and my non-Christian friends are listening to. There's Planet Money. So this is a field of behavioral economics. And then I'm blessed to work one day a week in the secular world. So as I'm operating, my anaesthetist is always reading a book. So sorry to break it to you, but really it's like flying a plane. Once you get it in the air, it's on autopilot. Once you're asleep, it's autopilot. All right? And this anaesthetist is either doing crosswords, having a coffee and a donut, or reading books. So I'm always asking, what are you reading? What are you reading? So I'm finding out from him what to read. And he's looking at me like, you haven't read this? Like, he's appalled, I've not even heard. So these non-Christians are appalled, you have not heard of their authors. And so he got me onto Karen Armstrong. He's going, you have not heard of Karen Armstrong, religious advisor to Barack Obama, religious advisor to the United Nations, ex-Catholic nun, has written Fields of Blood, Case for God. He's looking at me, how come you teach religion? You haven't heard of Karen Armstrong? Like, okay. And then he got me to, who was it? No. Oh, The Righteous Mind, Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan Haidt, The Righteous Mind, a liberal defending the conservative cause to liberals, saying, hey, you liberals have misunderstood conservative religious Christians. So he actually defends Christians for you. So you will pick up some amazing tools in that book, especially on how to do the homosexuality debate. I gained some amazing stuff from that book on how to explain it to liberals. I could go on. Okay. All right, so this is a Christian author. I think it's James Smith, is that right? James K.A. Smith, am I right on that? Was it James Smith or James Taylor? Taylor's a singer, hey. Okay, so he has summarised, this is why I get a mix up, Charles Taylor. Charles Taylor has a 900-page book out there that if anyone says they read it, they're bluffing. They have not read it. It's like that and Oliver O'Donovan. No one's read O'Donovan either. They're just bluffing. So no one has read Charles Taylor. They're just bluffing. But you read, James Smith has summarised it for the rest of us. And it's a book called How Not to Be Secular. And most of you read it because you're nodding your heads. And Taylor and Smith are arguing that the secular world is illegitimately living in an immanent frame as if there's no God, no transcendent, but borrowing from the transcendent world, it's illegitimately importing transcendent metaphysical concepts like purpose, meaning, hope. Like, really, how can you even talk about purpose, hope and meaning if there's no God? Like, if we're just atoms or molecules. And so suddenly you realize from these people that the non-Christian cultural storyline is always assuming purpose, meaning and hope. They can't get away from it. So, if you read Angela Duckworth, and these are not Christian books, her book is called Grit. It's basically how to be a high achiever. You've got to work hard. According to Duckworth, what is the secret to grit? In the end, you need purpose and hope. You're not going to keep doing what you do hard every day, like practice the piano or do laps in the swimming pool, unless there's purpose, like you're going to win a medal, and there's hope that you'll win a medal. So there's purpose and hope. So they're always illegitimately importing transcendent concepts into these self-help secular books. So, even Stephen Bidoff, what is the secret to job satisfaction? Purpose. Then you go to Bidoff, where do you get this purpose from? And then his last chapter is spirituality in manhood. So basically, for a man, you have to work hard, be faithful to your wife, get right with your dad. Final chapter is spirituality, because there's more to life than just atoms and molecules. Then you read Charles Duhigg, The Power of Habit. The Power of Habit. This is quoted by all the non-Christian authors. The Power of Habit, Charles Duhigg. Charles Duhigg says, basically, we're in this cycle where we behave. There's a stimulus, we behave, there's a reward, and that keeps... That's how we form good habits or bad habits. Addictions. Stimulus. It's Friday night. Behaviour. I will have a beer. Reward. I feel great. So now you always have a beer on Friday night. You've set up an addiction, a good habit or a bad habit. The only way to break it is recognise the stimulus, change the behaviour, get the same reward. I'm going to have a green tea. Oh look, I'm just as happy. Now you've broken the habit. But then Charles Duhigg says that only works up to a point, because there will be a time of crisis. You might get separated, someone might have cancer in the family, you might lose your job, you will revert back to the old habit unless you have horizontal accountability, someone to ring up, a community, and a belief in a transcendent purpose. And that's why Alcoholics Anonymous has to begin with step one, there is a God. So unless there's a transcendent purpose, I will always be locked in my addictions. So, what's another good one? I had another one off the top of my head. But basically, something I realized with all these non-Christian books, they always end by saying, you need hope, or you need purpose. That's their gold and silver bullet. And then you as a Christian say, that is so right, but if all you are is atoms and molecules, where are you going to get this? But if there's a God, that's actually the purpose and hope and meaning, and he'll give you better purpose, hope and meaning than what you could have dreamed of. Okay, I'll end with this one. So Malcolm Gladwell. No, I won't end with this one. I'll give you two more. Malcolm Gladwell, so David and Goliath. So you should read that. You won't agree with exegesis. You might not agree with exegesis. But it's all about the power of the underdog. And then he comes to the thing where the only way he can give positive examples, he has to give the French Huguenots as an example. And also a family of Mennonite faith as an example of what he's talking about. So he has to go religious. And halfway through the book changes its tone. And what has happened, you realize Gladwell actually became a Christian halfway through writing that book. So he returned to his Mennonite faith halfway through writing that book. And there's another book by Jennifer Senior. Oh, I don't know how to write Jennifer. Okay, Jennifer Senior, All Joy But No Fun. All Joy But No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenting. If you read this book, you have so many gold things you can say to parents who ask Q&A during Q&A time. I'll give you an example for free. One of her things is, the problem is we think we want to raise happy children. That's why we're forever chasing our tails. But it's impossible to raise happy children. Because how do you raise happy children? That's such a nebulous concept. We're actually trying to raise virtuous children of good character. Now that's achievable. Now you know how to do that. So that's one tidbit. Another one, she says, the problem in the 21st century is children are now emotionally rich but economically poor. where up until the 21st century, children were emotionally poor but economically rich. Like, the more children you had, the more they worked on the farm and made you rich and sustained your business, but you didn't give them any emotions. Like, you know, they were hurt, seen but not heard. Now, children are emotionally rich. They're happy, you're happy, they're sad, you're sad, but they're economically poor. They drain your money. They don't make money. So now that's a paradox of the 21st century. You say that, suddenly every parent's eyes on you, resonating. Yeah, you got me. That's my world. And then Jennifer Senior, to give an example of what she means of what parenting is, the transformation, she has to end with a Catholic grandmother as a positive role example. It ends spiritual. So what I found with most of these non-Christian books is they always have to resort, one, to transcendence, purpose, hope, meaning, and two, to a spiritual person as a concrete example of what they're talking about. So that's an easy common ground for our topical talks. Yes? Yeah, so I guess...
A lot of people wouldn't read those books.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess we just got to read what they're reading, watch what they're watching, listen to what they're listening to. And it's all about knowing your audience then.
I've been thinking about that same way you've been talking, because the kind of people I want to share the gospel with, they're not reading any of that.
Yeah.
But I think the Christians I'm working with in my church, they might read Narnia,
yeah,
they won't read Mere Christianity.
Yeah.
So they'll read popular Christian stuff, not realizing that the theory behind it has already been expressed.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether in this case, the people who I'm trying to work with would never read this.
Yeah.
But these people express it.
Yeah.
And so in a sense, they are the authors, not because they're reading them, because they're not reading books at all, they're reading magazines.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to find in Women's Weekly the kind of quote I need summarizes what life is about and how it expresses it.
Yeah. All right, yeah, so it's all about they're believing those, but they're watching different things. So you've got to know what they're watching. So Ravi Zacharias, and I got this from Jonathan Dykes, got it from Ravi Zacharias. So it's basically you're showing them three worlds as you give any talk. You're showing them philosophy, what they think or believe. You're showing them art, what they see or hear. And you're showing them the kitchen table, what they do. So, if you were to say, you believe, let's say you say, you believe the body is important. Exercise is important. You believe the body is important. They would immediately say, no, I don't. What do you mean I believe that? I don't think that at all. I've never thought that thought. Then you got to go, okay, this is what you do. Kitchen table is what you do. You get up every morning, and you watch what you eat, and you go for a run. Arts is what you see. You see people running around the lake every morning, signing up for bike events. This is because this is what we think. So you've got to go the reverse sequence. All right, so this is me. You believe in hope. No, I don't. You believe in purpose. No, I don't. Well, hang on. Every day you're working for a purpose. You're getting out of bed assuming this is going to take you somewhere. This is what you see. Then I quote them Gladwell or Steve Bidoff. That's because this is what you think. So what you're doing is the different groups are thinking the same things. You just got to show them different kitchen table examples and different arts examples. So I run a blog called Espresso Theology. .com, where every 2 weeks I give myself the challenge of, can I get from here to Jesus in 60 seconds? And it's not these highbrow books I'm talking about. So this week's post is on how to get from pulled pork to Jesus in 60 seconds. I've gone from Beyonce to Jesus in 60 seconds. So can I get from Beyonce, Taylor Swift, pulled pork, the mason jar, to Jesus in 60 seconds, so you can see what I try to do there. Yes?
So when you're talking about all these authors, and is part of it, like, are the people that you're talking to reading, listening, or is it just appealing to experts?
No, showing that I have read your authors, I've heard your story from your authors.
That's what I'm just wondering. So all the people are listening, you know, you quote all these TED Talks, you think
Yeah, I think they are. I think they really, really are. Yeah.
The people Sam's listening to are.
Yeah.
The people I talk to are.
Yeah. Are. And I'm scanning Facebook posts and I think, yep, this is what they're listening to. This is who they're quoting. Yep. Oh, yeah. So it's know your audience, contextualize for your audience. So Paul quotes Zeus, apparently, in Acts 17. He's not quoting Beyonce, but then we would quote Beyonce and not Zeus to our audience.
I was just wondering, because you particularly chose mostly TEDs in your book, rather than books, although you did have one at the end.
Yeah.
But is that because
I think most people are podcasting, they're not reading.
Sometimes it's really about knowing the people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Again, yeah, what are they doing? What are they seeing? Yeah.
Like the lifeline thing, everyone's one congregation, part of the lifeline. Huge stadium full of secondhand books.
I can't hear you, so they can't hear you.
I mentioned this lifeline book there as a joke in the sermon, like Jerusalem at this time, it's like Mecca. Yeah, it's like Mecca during the Hajj. It's like Sydney during Mardi Gras. It's like Canberra during the Lifeline.
Right.
And someone came up to me afterwards and was like, oh, he knows his people.
Right.
Right. And that was nothing. It was just a Canberra thing.
Yeah.
It was a joke. It was a throwaway line. It didn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing the people that he's talking to is really the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Who are they reading? What are they thinking? What are they believing?
Yep.
For the young professional worker in Sydney, of course, it's really that. And for the young professional in Canberra, it's really
that too. Right.
But for the Bogan, Nathan, Parks, it might be different. But it's the same principle. What do they believe? What do they think? Who do they listen to? Why do they believe
it? Sure. Jeremy, and then the question in the corner.
In your talk, I'm not sure if I switched off for a bit. You talk about the cross, and is that needed in
an
evangelistic topical talk?
Sure, okay. So I did mention the cross. So in the end, what is how do we define an evangelistic talk? There's a good book right now, Jackson Wu, One Gospel. All Nations, where he looks at how the gospel is communicated in all 66 books of the Bible. I've actually got a book on evangelism coming out with Zondervan next year. I do a very similar thing in one of my chapters. Look at all the gospel presentations in the Bible. And they basically come down to several components. Basically, who is God or who is Jesus? So this is the gospel message. Who is God? Who is Jesus? What has God or Jesus done? So what is the significance? As in, okay, the so what question. And then the implied response. Okay, and it's Carson is big on this as well. What we do is not part of the gospel message, but the gospel message does carry with it an implied response. So what is our response? If this is true. So these are the components. So then, because it's a focal, contextualized, 20-minute talk or presentation, you have to put some things in and you have to leave out 99% of the other stuff that's in the Bible. And that's its strength and that's its weakness. And it's always easy to take a shot at what was not said rather than what was said. So I teach my students this. As students, I often have to hand in an essay and a book review. And students are always stuck in the book review. Like, how do I critique a book? This author's way smarter than me. How can I critique a book? So I say, okay, the easiest way to write a book review is criticise the author for what they didn't say. Because they've got no comeback against that. And okay, so they've all learned how to write a book review. And same with any gospel presentation. We can always have a shot at what was not said rather than what was said. But in the end, because it's focal, it's contextualised, we can only say one thing and leave out the other 99 things. So that is the gospel thing. And then there are many metaphors. So do we choose Jesus as shepherd? And so what he's done is he's gone out and laid his life down for the sheep. The thing is we need to come back. Right now we're lost as sheep. If Jesus is king, what has he done? He's got a kingdom. What is the significance? Well, we need now to submit and be part of this kingdom. If we see Jesus as a groom, we need to be... that means what he's done is laid his life down for the church as a groom to the bride. What is the significance? I can be part of this union. And what do I need to do? I need to be now faithfully wed to this Jesus. Are you with me? So depending on which one you do, you can go down multiple different ways. So your question was, I did mention the cross. I think what it is I don't think you have to, and I go against Chapman in setting hearts on fire, because he would say you got to mention each and every time. I think, again, you don't have to mention each and every time, and here I'm treading carefully, because the cross is important, and it's also a mechanism for how salvation is brought in. So sometimes you can mention the significance and what we have to do without them having to understand the exact mechanism. And here I'll go a bit further and tease this out a bit more, because it's very important. So the missiologists talk about how there are at least three ways that the Bible communicates sin. But if you tease out, there's like 20, 40 ways. So the one we're most used to is sin is a trespass. So now we're guilty. So now we need to be forgiven or justified. Here, sin is being filthy, unholy. Well, so now we're blemished. So now we need to be made holy, washed, purified, cleansed. And the third one is sin is dishonor. We have failed to honor God. We have failed to honor God. So here, sin, the result is shame. We have shamed God. And so now what we need is we need to restore honor, and we need face from God. We need him to show us his face. So missiologists like Paul Hibbert say cultures resonate towards one of these more than the other two. So in modernity West, we resonate very much with this. I've broken a law. I'm guilty. I need to be forgiven. Muslim countries resonate a lot more with this one. I'm dirty. I need to be clean. And Asian countries resonate a lot more with this one. And interestingly now, I've played around. I think now that we're post-Christian, post-reach, and even post-westernized almost, I found this one really works for me in Australian audiences. So if I get up in front of a high school group, if I come in with this one, you know, there are laws, you think you're perfect, but you've broken one, you've broken them all, you're guilty, I can just see they're not listening. It's true, what I'm saying is true, but they're not engaged, they're not hearing me. This one I say, there's a God, he loves us, he made us, but we haven't honoured him. Oh, they are looking at me the whole time, their eyes have not left me. So somehow that gets through them. And then I look at how the apostles preach in the book of Acts. So to the Jews who had the scriptures, who should have known better, they come in with this one. You know, you've got God's scriptures. He sent you the Messiah. You killed the Messiah. You guys are guilty. And they go, oh my gosh, we need to be forgiven. What do we need to do? And then to the pagan cultures, there's a God. He's been very good to you. He sent you rain. He's given you crops to eat. But you're not honouring him. You're not worshipping this God. You're worshipping other gods, but you're not worshipping this God. So you need to go down this track. So in that sense, I think I'm going down other tracks. And I'll get to the question in the corner. I haven't forgotten. And I'm also employing another method here. In the past, with modernity, our sequence used to be like this. This is truth, so believe it, and if you believe it, you need to do it. All right, so that's the logical sequence. I'm finding now with post-Christian, post-Western, post-reach cultures, it seems to be the other way around. Hey, look at this is doable. You could do this. Well, if it's doable, it's believable, and if it's believable, it just might be true. So what I'm seeing here, this is the Bible's category of wisdom. I'm actually using wisdom to sneak the gospel in through a side entrance. So right now, you're working hard. Well, let's face it, it's not working, is it? It's not working. But imagine if you had a God. And this God sees everything you do. And he's got a purpose. And he's going to reward you. And you'll somehow bring his love, mercy, and justice on this planet. Whoa, I could do that. I'll get out of bed for that. Well, if you could get out of bed for that, do you think you could believe that there really is a God who loves you and made you and he's got a purpose? If this is believable, come and check out everything else because it must be true. So I'm actually using... So the more and more I think about, we traditionally came in with a salvation historical front door. You're a sinner. You're going to hell. You're condemned. You need to be forgiven. And they go, yeah, you're so right. Now I'm thinking, okay, I need to take a few more steps before I get to the salvation history bit. I'm going to show them wisdom. Look, this works. Do you think you can just try it out? This is believable. Well, okay, there's something else you need to know about this God, the salvation history. And there's three categories of the way God interacts with the world in the Bible. There's providence, God's daily interaction with the world. There's wisdom, the design and purpose he's put into this world. And then there's salvation. And all three are complementary in the Bible. So if you think about it, providence is a prayer, guidance, our daily interaction with the world as well. Genesis 1 and 2, work the garden. Salvation is the Great Commission mandate. Go, make disciples of all nations, preach repentance in my name. And wisdom is that big middle chunk of the Bible of, you know, be faithful to your wife, be a good father to your children, don't gossip at work. This is how life would look like if you're in... And I think often we've been coming in this way. So two ways to live. Kirk Passon and others point out, notice in the last square, the world disappears because it's gone so salvation, it's left out the providence and wisdom bit. So now we're quite deficient in this area. So now I'm thinking, okay, maybe just balance it a bit more, a bit more of a diet of this as well as this. So that's the method behind the madness. All right, question in the corner?
We're going to need to
keep. Oh, okay. That's right, we've got more time after lunch, haven't we?
We have got a bit more time. There's other questions. Do you want to take one more and then we'll have lunch?
You happy with that?
Yeah, that's perfect. I'm going to go to the top end of literature, 50 Shades of Grey. There's a new movie coming out, I believe, or close to it. I don't know if it's been released. It seems to me, I need to be quick. There's a gospel conversation with Ready and Able to happen in the office. The invitation comes, we're going to see it. Can you show me how I can take that invitation to Jesus and the person in our
congregation? Sure. Yep. So the question was... As a cultural text example, what about things like 50 Shades of Grey? How would you get from that to the gospel or Jesus? All right, so just a few clearing throat things to say first, and then we'll get into it. Again, it's that whole relationship between general revelation, common grace, and special revelation, the gospel. And some of us be worried, well, 50 Shades of Grey, what do we do with something like that? So we have the issue of human sin and depravity going on in our world as well. Let's not be so naive, we can't embrace everything. I remember Tim Keller putting it quite well. Because of common grace, no non-Christian culture is as depraved as it could be. God always finds a way to put some goodness or truth. So all truth is God's truth. So somehow we still need to say, okay, no matter how depraved this is, there's still some goodness and truth in here somehow, okay? And then Keller makes us humble. He says, and because of human depravity, no Christian culture is as holy as it should be. So before, you know, you point out the speck in someone's eye, look at the log in your own eye first. So we've got more overlap than maybe we realise. Second thing in a clearing the throat exercise is missiologists, and I wish I could give you their names. They talk about a spectrum from W1 all the way to W4 in the way you work. Well, that's what the W stands for, with a non-Christian culture. So W1 is down this end of the spectrum where basically you work against their culture. Like, your culture is wrong, Christ is better, Christ triumphs, Christ replaces your culture. W4 down this end of the spectrum is where you work with their culture. You woo them along. Hey, you guys have come along well. You just need to come a bit further and look, you're going to find Jesus. All right, and there's a place for it in the Bible. We find examples of W1, 2, 3, and 4 in the Bible. Extreme example of W1 would be Jesus with a whip in the temple. Look at this, it's terrible. He knocks them all out. Example of W4 would be Paul in Athens. You've got idols, but rather than destroying them, come, you just need to come a bit further and you're going to find Jesus. So you work with their culture. So your question is, how can I do W4 with 50 shades of grey? Well, what I like to do is think, okay, because of image of God, all of us are in the image of God, because according to Ecclesiastes, we have a cry for eternity. Somehow we're all crying out for transcendence, purpose, hope, and meaning. And because of general revelation, somehow there's truth in here and goodness in here. So what I try to do is think, what is the storyline here? So what is the mission and what is the happy ending here according to this cultural storyline in this text, so 50 Shades of Grey? What is the human existential cry that's being fulfilled by the happy ending? And then I read something like Huma Kai, What Makes Us Tick, the top 10 human desires that drive us. And I think, okay, which one of these 10 desires is being fulfilled by the happy ending in 50 Shades of Grey? Is it the desire for being recognised and special? Is it a desire for belonging? Is it a desire for community? So trying to say, okay, it could be more than one, but okay, I'm going to go for this one. Maybe it's a desire for love and belonging. And then I'm going to show how, get them nodding their heads by saying, hey, you know what I love about this book is it shows we have a desire for love and belonging. But then you throw in a but notice how the happy ending isn't the happy ending we think it is. But look, with Jesus we can get the happy ending we're after. So I'll give you an example. My wife and I watched The Duff. So it's a romantic comedy for teenagers. And it's actually a desire for status, I think, to be recognised, to be special, to be somebody, which is Huma Kai's number one desire. And it's to say somehow in every hierarchy and pond, we'll always be at the bottom. We'll be someone's duff, the designated ugly fat friend, duff. So it doesn't matter how good you are, eventually you're going to find a pond where you're the duff. Okay? So the solution then is, don't care what other people say, in the end it's just what you say about yourself.